Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Bella, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Current Perspectives on the Future of Cancer Research. And today's program is supported by an educational grant from Daiichi Sankyo and made possible through an independent grant from Merck and Company, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of the program. Now, before I introduce our speakers, we have quite a few speakers today, I actually would like to welcome everyone to the call today, and I also want to identify that you are from many different parts of the world and from many different parts of the United States. In terms of the United States, we have over 140 participants from the United States in both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, the Philippines, Romania, Uganda, and the United Kingdom. So it is a truly a global call, and it's really a pleasure to know that so many of you internationally are participating in this call today. And our first speaker is Dr. Michael Offen, and Dr. Offen is assistant attending Thoracic Oncology Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Offen will be addressing understanding the current perspectives on the future of cancer research and clinical trials, enhanced knowledge of the molecular portrait of cancer, and antibody drug conjugates, ADCs. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Offen.
Thank you for that kind introduction. Hi to all on the call. My name is Michael Offen. I'm from Memorial Sloan Kettering. So I'm here to kind of give a broad overview in terms of the kind of current state of research in oncologic care, and then a little bit of specifics on antibody drug conjugates. So in general, we've come a long way in the treatment of cancers. We are now much more adept at understanding the molecular characteristics and the biology that make cancers grow and spread. Back in the day, we used to think solid tumors were kind of all somewhat similar and they were treated somewhat similar, but nowadays it's not, you know, enough just to say somebody has a lung cancer, but we're able to break that down by the type of cancer, the genetic issues in the cancer, and tailor our treatments towards that. In that vein, I wanted to talk a bit about targeted therapies in regards to antibody drug conjugates and targeted immunotherapies. So what these kind of new compounds are we've known since around the 1970s when there was a Nobel Prize about the body being able to make antibodies against cancer, that we may be able to exploit this. In recent years, there have been antibodies that were formed, monoclonal antibodies, meaning a single antibody, that goes against certain factors that help cancer grow, things like blood vessel growth factors and certain markers on certain types of leukemia cells, and those have been around for a while. Now what we're trying to do is make the next generation of these antibodies. We're actually utilizing the antibody as a homing missile, if you will, and they look for specific targets on the cancer cells. So for instance, there is a drug that is FDA approved in breast cancer, and that drug actually looks for a marker called TROP2, which is a protein. And when that antibody finds the protein, it latches on and then stings it with a warhead. That warhead tends to be a chemotherapy-type drug. So it's almost a smarter way of delivering chemotherapy. These types of drugs are very exciting. There are hundreds in development. And I think this will likely play a role in research years to come, as well as likely FDA approvals. On that same vein, there's also this kind of approach of targeted immunotherapies, which similarly would use an antibody to hone in on a certain target, but instead of hitting it with a chemotherapy warhead, it then uses part of it to actually call in the immune system. And so one can imagine that, for instance, in lung cancers, there's a recent FDA approval of a drug where It looks for a certain marker on small cell lung cancer, and when it finds it, it then tries to get the immune system to engage the cancer cell. So these new novel constructs are ways for us to either engage immune systems or deliver chemotherapy-type medications, but in a much more refined way, with the goal of increasing response rate and hopeful better tolerability for our patients. Some of these are available standard of care with FDA approval, but there are also many ongoing clinical trials, and I would advocate that you talk to your oncologist about these. Thank you for your time, and I'll be available for questions.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Offen. And I'm sure there'll be lots of questions for you as well. Thank you. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Sarah Grisales-Jaramillo. She's an oncology social worker, and she's our InSlice and Call Center Program Manager for Cancer Care. And she'll be discussing healthcare disparities research and its future significance for greater access to healthcare. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Jaramillo.
Thank you so much for the introduction. As an oncology social worker, I see every day how cancer affects not just the physical body, but the whole experience. That includes family, communities, and futures. When we talk about disparities in research, we're not just talking about numbers, we're talking about people. As a low-income mother in a rural community who's never been offered a clinical trial, a Black man diagnosed with prostate cancer whose treatment options are based on research data that may not have included him at the time, a Spanish-speaking patient whose questions go unanswered because the research team does not speak their language or understand their experience. These are not rare stories. They are common. So here's the reality. Many of the communities facing the highest cancer burdens, like Black, Latino, Indigenous, low-income, and immigrant groups, are the least likely to be included in research that drives prevention and treatment. Clinical trials often miss people who need it the most. Genomic studies, the very basis of precision medicine, often do not reflect diversity of our population. And some historical events, like the Tuskegee study, have left a legacy of mistrust. As care providers, we must acknowledge and work to heal. But the barriers go deeper. Transportation, housing stability, health literacy, and even simply navigating the system can prevent someone from participating in research or accessing care. Here's what I know from sitting with patients. When you're left out of the research, you're left out of potential life-saving treatments. When care is based on data that doesn't represent everyone, outcomes are unequal. And that's not a coincidence. That is a system design flaw. So what does this mean for access to care? Because research drives care, if underserved groups aren't represented in the research, they are less likely to benefit from the results. Think about clinical guidelines, drug approvals, AI diagnostics. If the evidence base is incomplete or biased, then the care delivery will be too. Equity in research is the foundation for equity in treatment. The future of cancer research must be human-centered and equity-driven. That means bringing trials to the community, not just academic centers. It means partnering with trusted local voices to rebuild trust and improve communication between doctors and patients. It means funding research led by diverse investigators who bring essential cultural understanding to their work. And it means tracking outcomes, not just by efficacy, but by equity. As healthcare professionals, we have the power to shift the way cancer research is done, because every patient deserves to be counted for, and every voice deserves to be heard. For patients and caregivers that are listening, reach out to organizations that focus on healthcare disparities and research, or find someone in your healthcare team to provide you with information about cancer research and how to navigate clinical trials. It is essential for you to know that you or your loved one deserve to be a part of discovering potential life-changing treatments. Thank you so much for listening.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Jaramillo. That was just a wonderful presentation. It's so important in terms of the future of cancer research, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Aparna Kalyan. And Dr. Kalyan is Associate Professor medicine, hematology and oncology, surgery, organ transplantation, Northwestern University Clinical and Translational Sciences Institute, NCUCATS, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Kalyan will be addressing current perspectives on the future of microsatellite instability, or MSI, mutations in DNA, mismatch repair genes, and the future implications for treatment. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Kalyan.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a delight to be here. So when we think about cancer treatment, historically, we've always focused on surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, and some of the newer medicines like targeted therapy. But I think one thing that we've sort of come to understand a little bit more is something called DNA spell checkers, or you might hear words called microsatellite instability. So if we imagine our DNA as sort of a big book of instructions, every time our body, our cells divide, they tend to make a copy of this book. Now, as you can imagine, during this process of copying, you can get some mistakes. And our body, being pretty impressive, has some teams of cells or genes that are called mismatch repair genes. And they sort of work like spell checkers or proofreaders, where they go and fix all these mistakes. Now, what happens if these proofreaders or these spell checkers have a mutation and it doesn't work very well? That's where the term microsatellite instability comes in, or MSI. It means that there are these tiny repetitive stretches of DNA called microsatellites where there is a mistake and it hasn't been fixed by the spell checker, and that in turn leads to mistakes. Now, it turns out that having these broken spell checkers, or being called MSI high, is actually a really good thing from a cancer treatment perspective. For a long time, we looked at these as sort of just a way to look to see if there are other cancers in the family. But now we've come to understand that it actually means a big deal from a treatment perspective. And why is that? Because when you have a tumor with all of these uncorrected mistakes, it tends to look weird to our immune system. And the immune system actually wakes up and sort of says, wait, this isn't normal. I've got to do something about it. And that actually allows medications like immunotherapy to work really well. These drugs don't directly kill the cancer, but they essentially take the brakes off our own body's immune system to allow better recognition of the cancer cells. So patients who are MSI high, these immunotherapy medications work incredibly well. So one thing that we've come to recognize is that patients, particularly a lot of times in GI cancers, so cancers like colon, pancreas, gastric, it's really important that you speak to your oncologist about getting the microsatellite testing done, because it might potentially open up the opportunity to use immunotherapy. And now there's a lot of work that is being done to see if we could go beyond just immunotherapy. Are there perhaps other medicines that we could use in this space to improve treatment options without having as many side effects that we might get with traditional chemotherapy? Once again, I want to thank everybody for giving me this opportunity.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Kalyan. Just a wonderful presentation. And I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Michael Wong. And Dr. Wong is Physician in Chief, Roswell Park Cancer Institute. And Dr. Wong will be addressing the future of artificial intelligence, AI-driven approaches for diagnosis and treatment of cancer and cancer treatment vaccines. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Wong.
Thank you, Dr. Misner. It's an honor and privilege to join you all today, and I just want to point out what an all-star cast of fellow speakers I have with me today, and I'm here taking notes and learning so much from all my colleagues. And adding to that, I want to talk about artificial intelligence. it's a very hot topic now, and perhaps one way to talk about it and to introduce the concept is the fact that it's artificial intelligence isn't that intelligent. It is a methodology to look at data and using that look back in a sophisticated way to understand patterns and presentations in a way that helps us gather information and in a way that helps us come to diagnosis and treatment. The important thing to do today is to realize that AI, as we call artificial intelligence, in the area of diagnosis and treatment is one that's still yet immature. People are trying to figure out how to use it. But already you should know that by looking backwards means that it has no capacity to predict the future in a way that is rational. It uses information that we already have in the system. So therefore, one of the weak points is that you are using the information you already have, and that information that's there is a varying quality. And we know that as technology improves and changes, the information we have at hand also changes in a way that's both qualitative and quantitatively different. So AI will continue to evolve. And right now, today, in the realm of diagnosis and treatment, we have what's called a human in a loop. Which, what does that mean? It means that by use of these algorithms and computer-generated software, you still have a person who looks at the data to see if it makes sense. To my knowledge, there is no situation in which the definitive diagnosis and treatment, that when where we get to the point where we push the button and treat a patient, there's no system that I know of currently that is autonomous. In other words, you still have to have a person look at it to see if it makes sense. Now, that drives me to the second topic, which is cancer treatment vaccines. And there's been a lot of attention paid to vaccines, but really in the most simplest way of explaining it, a vaccine is a strategy in which you are using some sort of material that you can introduce to the body, and which will stimulate that person or that body's immune response. And the material that you introduce could be any variety of molecules. It could be proteins, it could be pieces of mRNA, pieces of DNA, or even molecules that can cause inflammation. What you are trying to achieve is to stimulate that body's immune system to respond against that. And in a cancer arena, there's a use of molecules such as DNA. There's use of even attenuated vaccines, sorry, attenuated viral vectors that will stimulate an immune response. At the end of the day, what you're trying to do is stimulate that person's body to react in a way against the target. So if you put a vaccine in that simulates the body's reaction against that cancer, then that's the intention. And the end result is to get to a long-term control of what you're aiming for. And vaccines were pioneered in the area of infectious diseases. We talk about things like measles and polio and things like that, and smallpox, which have been almost nearly eradicated with active vaccine programs. We are adopting that same strategy to cancer. Now, how do we link these two things together? We are using AI to help us predict some of the molecules that may be helpful. We can look at what has worked in the past and look at these patterns and try to predict what we could use in the future that may be helpful. Again, you should realize that from what I've told you, that is based on using the information that's already in the data bank. So let me end by saying that this is a time of incredible opportunity, incredible changes in science. I know for a fact that when I come back and talk about this very same topic in the near future, we'll be talking about different things because things are changing so rapidly. Once again, I want to thank everyone for your time and attention. I will be happy to take questions, and I thank Dr. Messner and her group once again for allowing me to speak to you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Wong. Just a wonderful presentation, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Joshua Fine, and Dr. Fine is a fellow hematology and oncology, Weill Cornell Medicine, New York Presbyterian. And Dr. Fine will be addressing CAR T cell therapy, immune checkpoint inhibitors and blockade, and monoclonal antibodies. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Fine.
Thanks, Dr. Messner, for the introduction for the wonderful work that you and Cancer Care do. It's a real honor to join this panel, this exceptional group of speakers today. Joshua Fine, I'm a fellow and about to be an assistant professor at Weill Cornell, where my day-to-day focus is both on the research and caring for patients who undergo bone marrow transplants, which is arguably the original immune or cell therapy. In that context, for blood cancers, most often acute leukemia. But I get the privilege today of talking about what I think is really the bleeding edge right now of cancer care, CAR T cells, immune checkpoint blockade, these next generation monoclonal antibodies that are all variations on the idea of teaching the immune system new tricks, teaching an old dog new tricks so that it can really hunt down and hopefully entirely eliminate cancer. Starting with CAR T therapy, this is the strategy of taking a patient's own immune cells out of their body, sending them off to a manufacturing process that then teaches them by genetically modifying them outside the body to recognize a specific marker that's common to all of the cancer cells. And these are therapy that we're now 10 years into the era of using CAR T therapy. And this strategy has proven to be potentially curative for many lymphomas, for some leukemias, and also induces really long-lasting responses in many myeloma cases. Unfortunately, that strategy hasn't had the same success on the solid tumor side. But very recently, last year, we saw the approval of a new type of therapy, which is very much related to this, called tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes. And in this case, instead of taking immune cells like T cells just from the bloodstream, we're able to take samples of the actual tumor itself and find T cells. These are those wonderful immune cells that are dedicated killers that identify foreign things and track them down and kill them. So if we take lymphocytes, T cells from the tumor that have already figured out how to find the tumor, we can grow them outside the body again and give them back to the patient with the idea that we've already found the ones that are going to work. And this has been very successful now in melanoma, where it's been approved in the last year. It's an area of tremendous excitement right now. There are ongoing trials in a number of different solid tumors, especially in lung cancer, endometrial cancer, but it's really, I think, an area that we're going to see growth in across many, many tumors. And we're finally starting to learn how to subtly manipulate these killer T cells so that they are as effective as possible once they're reinfused into patients. But there's still a lot of work to be done on the CAR side and on the TIL side, those two therapies I talked about, to make them successful across the broadest range of diagnoses and to increase the likelihood that we're going to achieve a sustained, long-lasting, or hopefully even curative response. When we look on the other side at checkpoint inhibitors, this immune checkpoint blockade, this takes a different approach. Instead of taking the cells out of the body, we say, can we redirect the T cells that are already in the body using a medication, using immune checkpoint inhibitors to take away some of the flags that cells can put up to say, I'm a good guy, don't kill me. And we're about 15 years now into the checkpoint inhibitor era, and this is a therapy that has already yielded Nobel Prizes, and even more important than that, has really reshaped the way that we treat over 20 different cancers. These are incredibly powerful therapies, and in some rare cases, we've seen patients who receive checkpoint inhibitor therapy for metastatic cancers that otherwise we think of as generally not curable, go on to have complete durable remissions that are extended over so many years, we may have actually cured the disease. So these are really exciting directions that the field has been heading already for the last decade or so. Checkpoint inhibitors are a type of monoclonal antibodies. You heard about another type of monoclonal antibodies at the beginning from Dr. Offen, these antibody-drug conjugates. But overall, these are different strategies to really focus on a particular cell and modify it, do something to it, kill it, or otherwise redirect it. And so that is the universe of these therapies that we're really finding are so successful in treating cancers. But where do we go from here? What is on the horizon? Well, we still need to address these two fundamental questions. How do we make these therapies successful for diseases where they don't work, or for patients, even with diseases where they do work, that don't respond to them? And how do we maximize that duration of response, achieving either long-lasting remissions or, we hope, actually curing as many patients as possible? There are a lot of different avenues for that research right now, but I want to point to one that I think is really the most compelling, exciting, an area of a lot of growth right now, and that's understanding the influence of the broader body environment on this retrained or modified immune system. So things like diet and the microbiome, and even things like how time of day influences the immune system, or how the patient's sex influences the immune system. The microbiome is an area that I'm particularly fascinated by, because if you think about it, we human beings are collections of an entire universe of organisms, bacteria, fungi, viruses that live within us. There's actually more microbes in us than there are stars in the entire galaxy. And there's really strong evidence that this constellation of bacteria actually critically modify the function of the immune system. And so understanding that is really integral to knowing how to maximize the efficacy of CAR T cells, of immune checkpoint blockade, of monoclonal antibodies as we move forward. There's a lot of exciting research in this already, and I think it's a direction that's going to continue to grow. Likewise, understanding how does time of day affect how the immune system behaves, there's sort of a anti-cancer jet lag, if you will, or how does the exposure to sex hormones like testosterone or estrogen affect the immune system? These are things that give us new levers we can manipulate when we're using these therapies. So as we continue to learn how the body environment shapes our immune system, I really believe we're going to learn how to manipulate these signals and maximize our ability to fight cancers with immune therapies. And all of this really depends on the incredible gift that patients give us when they partner with us as participants in clinical trials and as advocates of all of this research that we're doing. So with that, I want to thank you all for your attention and look forward to answering questions later on.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Fine. That was really excellent. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin. Dr. Slovin is attending physician, genitourinary oncology service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. And Dr. Slovin will be addressing the future perspectives on immunotherapy and targeted immunotherapies. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Slovin.
Thank you very much, Dr. Messner, and welcome to everybody. I think you've heard really a tremendous amount of wonderful information about all these new immune-directed therapies and the impact they've had on a wide variety of cancers. The elephant in the room, as they like to say, is really when a patient comes in, they want to know why they have cancer. And I think it's very important, if I take a step back from all these wonderful talks that you just heard, is to really make you aware that the body is under immune surveillance 24/7, 365 days out of the year. We have our own group of cells and proteins that are constantly in the circulation, surveying and trying to contain any abnormal cells that develop in the body. And interestingly, most of these normal cells end up being normal tissue that is somehow under selection pressure, meaning that they mutate or change for a variety of reasons, and they become abnormal. The interesting aspect of this is that the immune system, our body, doesn't really recognize them as being abnormal, because quite frankly, to the immune system, it looks the same, but maybe there's something on the surface of the cell that has changed, or there's a different conformation of sugars that are in a particular arrangement on the cell surface that have also changed, and therefore they don't really recognize. Now, when people say, why do I have cancer? It's because, for the most part, that there's a problem with immune surveillance. What the exact problem is, we really don't know, but it can be environmental, it can be something within the body, it could be toxic exposure. It's a variety of different things. And that leads to the whole desire to do immunotherapy. Now, what is immunotherapy in the retrospectoscope? Based on all our conversations, you heard about treatments, but the reality is trying to use the body's own immune system to fight cancer. Why? Well, we'd like to think that using the body's immune system is less toxic, it's safer. Patients want to avoid chemotherapy, which they consider to be a group of poisons that are going to really hurt them, although we know better, it can be very helpful and can save people's lives. But what we are now learning is that there's a variety of very new targets, molecules or proteins that are on the surface of the cancer cells, to which all of these immune therapies that you've heard about, the antibody drug conjugates, CAR T cells, a group of cells known as bispecific T cell engagers, all of those are directed to different molecules. And believe it or not, we have millions of them, billions of them. We just haven't found them all. And we're hoping, of course, as Dr. Wong mentioned, that maybe artificial intelligence will help us identify them and help us determine which molecules might be, at the end of the day, the best ones. Now, it may not be one. It may be a whole group of them. We really do not know. So where does that leave us with, you know, the idea of immunotherapy? How do we deal with taking the immune system and using it? Well, you got to remember one other thing. Not all cancers are equal. We do know that, for example, lung cancer, bladder cancer, kidney cancer, melanoma, head and neck cancers are all very susceptible to a wide variety of immune therapies. Doesn't make a difference. The checkpoint inhibitors are one group, but there's a whole group of other ones that work equally well. And why is that to be the case? Well, because they have a lot of abnormalities in genetics. They mutate. And they mutate a lot more than the tumor that I deal with all the time, which is prostate cancer, which is really not as robust as we'd like. And one of the problems about prostate is that it doesn't have a lot of mutations, and it's not thought to have a lot of immune cells within the tumor itself. You've already heard about tumor infiltrating lymphocytes from Dr. Fine. Well, there's just so many different things that are going on in the actual tumor environment, or as we like to call it, the tumor microenvironment or the tumor milieu, that makes it very complicated to make any one therapy work. And frankly, I would say most of us say that immune therapies may work as single agents with certain cancers, but there are other cancers, prostate in particular, for which that doesn't work, which is why we are so devoted to trying to find treatments and to strategize treatments so that maybe one treatment alone is not going to be enough, but maybe if we combine a checkpoint inhibitor with an antibody drug conjugate or a CAR T cell, we can actually cause an anti-tumor response. So I want our listeners to be aware that immunotherapy is very much a part of our treatment regimens, but that everybody needs to understand that the most important thing that we are trying to do is to keep your immune system active, which it is. You can still fight any sort of infection, but it's a different part of the immune system that is involved with fighting the cancer. So with that, I will say thank you, and I turn it back to you, Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Slevin. That was a superb presentation, and I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Jeffrey Bruce. Dr. Bruce is the Edgar M. Hospian Professor of Neurosurgical Surgery, Vice Chairman of Academic Affairs, New York Presbyterian Columbia University Medical Center, Director Bartoli Brain Tumor Research Laboratory, Co-Director Brain Tumor Center, and Dr. Bruce will be addressing the future perspectives on surgery and robotic surgery. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Bruce.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's a pleasure to be able to work with Cancer Care on this terrific seminar and discuss the future of surgery and robotic surgery. As someone who spent a career in the surgical treatment of brain tumors, I've had a front row seat to the rapid evolution of surgical technologies. There's never been a more exciting time to be involved in surgical innovation, especially as we stand at the threshold of integrating robotics, artificial intelligence, and advanced visualization techniques into routine care. Let's begin with the foundational truth that surgery remains one of the most effective and cost-efficient treatments for many early-stage solid tumors. The principle of surgery is straightforward: to remove the tumor while preserving as much normal function as possible. To achieve this, the surgeon must clearly visualize the anatomy, distinguish healthy tissue from diseased tissue, and avoid critical structures like nerves and blood vessels. This need for enhanced precision is what drives technological innovation in our field. One of the most transformative changes in recent years has been the integration of image-guided systems into the operating room. Preoperative MRIs or CT scans can now be actually overlaid in real time to bring the surgeon's hands with remarkable accuracy. In neurosurgery, where millimeters matter, this technology has been a game changer. It allows us to navigate complex anatomy safely and to more precisely remove tumors while minimizing damage to healthy brain tissue. Fluorescence guidance surgery is another breakthrough. By injecting a fluorescent dye that accumulates preferentially in tumor tissue, we can use specialized lighting to make the cancerous tissue literally glow. This visual contrast helps the surgeon to distinguish between tumor and normal tissue, leading to more complete and safer resections. Robotic surgery represents the next frontier. Currently, robotic systems are widely used in procedures like gallbladder removal, hernia repairs, and prostate removals. These platforms allow for extremely fine and stable movements, allows access to very tight anatomical spaces, and overall smaller incisions. Patients benefit from faster recovery, less postoperative pain, and lower infection risk. The three-dimensional visualization and enhanced dexterity that robotic systems provide are really unmatched in conventional laparoscopic surgery. The future of robotic surgery is being shaped by artificial intelligence. Algorithms are being trained to assist with intraoperative decisions and even to perform specific tasks with limited human input. Machine learning is improving pattern recognition for diagnostics, intraoperative guidance, and postoperative outcome predictions. In the long run, we may see semi-autonomous or fully autonomous surgical interventions. Looking even further ahead, telesurgery could revolutionize access to specialized care. You can imagine a world where a highly experienced surgeon in New York can operate on a patient in a remote village thousands of miles away, all in real time. With advancements in 5G and high-speed networks, this concept is no longer science fiction. It's a real possibility for the future. So, in conclusion, the future of surgery lies in our ability to enhance visualization, increase precision, and integrate intelligent technologies that support clinical decision-making. Robotics and AI are not replacing surgeons. They are empowering us. Surgeons will continue to be vital members of the cancer care team, not only in the operating room, but also in research, innovation, and clinical trials. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Bruce. That was really just a wonderful presentation and very, just really giving people lots of information about how surgery is changing and what innovations have really allowed that to happen. So thank you so much.
And our next speaker is Dr. James Robert Jenenpol Naylor, and he's a radiation oncologist with Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and he'll be discussing radiopharmaceutical therapy, or RPT. It's my pleasure now to introduce to you my esteemed colleague, Dr. Naylor.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. So to get one of the often questions out of the way is that radiation sometimes is a scary word, but it has been used to treat cancer dating back to the 1890s. The other thing that we use radioactive substances for all the time is in the diagnosis and workup of cancers. What many cancer patients are used to is getting PET scans. More commonly, one of the most common is an FDG PET scan, which tells us where there's a lot of active growing things. However, newer agents and new developments, and the development of radiopharmaceuticals are at the crux of this, is trying to help us get better at diagnosis and localized treatment, as well as targeting therapy. So one metaphor I sometimes use is that cancer is like a weed in a garden, with the patient's body being the garden. And if there is only one spot for early stage cancer, surgery or sometimes radiation can be curative. Sometimes we need to see if there are other weeds out there or if there are seeds somewhere else in the body. And now we have newer tracer agents. One of the most common one for prostate world is PSMA PET scans. And those help us see better and see more clearly if there are small other deposits of cancer elsewhere in the body. And that helps us change and tailor and target our treatments. Radiopharmaceuticals enable us both to more precisely visualize cancer with more targeted agents, things that let these PET scanners detect small deposits of specific cancer, but it also allows us to potentially target these spots. So going back to my metaphor, if there's multiple weeds in the garden, and you don't want to just operate or radiate with external beam radiation because that would be too damaging, you need to spray the garden. And as some of these other wonderful talks so far have mentioned, the goal really is to treat all of the cancer and minimize the side effects elsewhere. And so similar to antibody-drug conjugates, radiopharmaceuticals are designed to target these lesions that we're seeing on these new scanners and also deliver a payload, a stinger, if you will, that instead of a drug, it's a radioactive substance. There's different types. They kind of fall into two big categories of alpha and beta particles, for those of you who are well-versed in physics. But the principle remains the same, that it goes to those spots of cancer, and it delivers radiation and kills those areas off. We're learning more and more about how effective these are. These are kind of going through the progress. We now have trials that show that they're effective in various different cancers. So, for example, in prostate cancer, we have Pluvicto and Xofigo. But there are also things for neuroendocrine or pheochromocytomas, paragangliomas, targeting different tracers, as well as Dotatate. On the horizon, we're hoping to link things with other tracers. Can we link it with HER2, which would allow targeting of breast cancer or GI malignancies? Could we combine it with other drug therapies? Could you combine a radiopharmaceutical, a radioactive agent, with an ADC payload? And could that help further benefit these patients and give a better chance of killing off all of these deposits? We're really just scratching the surface of these. There's so much research that needs to be done, both just on, you know, development and infrastructure for how we can safely deliver these, but also for how we should combine these with other strategies that you've heard about, as well as our more conventional approaches. So I think the future is bright. There are multiple ongoing studies, and the goal of these really is to give targeted radiation that will help kill these cancers off with very few side effects. That it's given throughout your body, but it just targets those cancer lesions. So I appreciate the time, and happy to discuss more in questions later.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Jenenpol Naylor. Excellent presentation. I'm sure there'll be questions for you as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Shanugh Pandya,
And Dr. Pandya is a hematology, oncology, and integrative medicine in hematology, oncology, IMHO fellow, University of Arizona, Tucson. And Dr. Chandra will be addressing increasing focus on prevention, early detection, lifestyle, exercise, nutrition, and hydration. And I turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Pandya.
Thank you, Carolyn. Thank you for that introduction, and thank you, everyone, for being here. It's been a great series so far, and it's my privilege to talk about something that I'm very passionate about, which is how we eat, how we move, how we take care of ourselves during this journey. So I will briefly share some current recommendations and where future research may be headed, especially in the areas of nutrition, exercise, and lifestyle. When it comes to nutrition, there is strong evidence, especially from extensive research on the Mediterranean diet specifically, that a plant-forward, anti-inflammatory eating pattern can reduce the risk of developing cancer significantly and also prevent recurrence. In my experience, at least in clinics, patients often feel much more energized and just less inflamed in general when there is a shift towards a real whole food-based diet. What that looks like is focusing on vegetables, fruits, legumes, nuts and seeds, whole grains, olive oil, and omega-3 rich foods, and limiting added sugars, processed foods, and red and processed meats. I think the future research in this area, it will be really much more personalized, and the term is personalized nutrition, which really looks at how specific diets and foods interact with our own microbiome and our own genetics, as well as our individual health needs. Future research is also looking at how these dietary changes can impact genes and function specifically in cancer cells. These are really the omics studies, which are nutrigenomics or metabolomics. And right now, it's still an ongoing process. Large-scale nutrition research is very challenging. As you can imagine, people eat whole meals, not just isolated foods and ingredients, which doesn't quite fit well with our traditional testing of one variable at a time in clinical trials. But really, personalized nutrition is really where the future is headed. When it comes to exercise, we know that even gentle, consistent movements help people feel more grounded, sleep better, and really tolerate treatments with fewer side effects. And in fact, exercise is actually the most effective treatment for cancer-related fatigue. The current research supports about 150 minutes of moderate physical activity, which equates to brisk walking, and if able, adding at least two sessions of resistance training, which involves light weights or body weight exercises, which, you know, can be really difficult during treatment. So I often tell people even 5 to 10 minutes of movement is a great place to start. There's no really right way. What really matters is doing what feels doable and sustainable. A lot of current research supports exercise, again, for energy, mood, digestion, immune function, and even treatment response. There are multiple studies in recent years which have looked at high-intensity interval training in specifically prostate cancer, showing improved fatigue, but also slowing the PSA rise. So I think the future research in this area will be exploring more adaptive biosensor or wearable device-based personalized approaches to movement and exercise. And the biggest advantage to research in this area will be its reach in terms of reaching people in remote and underserved areas where directly monitored exercise plans can be difficult to provide. And I imagine AI will be a big part of this shift as well. Hydration is often overlooked, but it plays a big role in just energy, digestion, medication, metabolism. The current recommendations are 2 to 2.5 liters per day, and that can include water, herbal teas, infused waters if plain water isn't appealing. Hydration supports, again, the kidney function, but can also help reduce symptoms like dizziness and constipation. And the future research in this area is looking at how it impacts gut health, the microbiome, and again, cognition. So these are all things that we're starting to study a little bit more closely. Coping with stress is a big part of this journey. Many people say it's hard to slow down or sit still, and even a few deep breaths can shift how we feel moment to moment. We know that mind-body practices like mindfulness, yoga, tai chi, and breath work can reduce anxiety, improve sleep, and just promote overall emotional wellness. Future research in this area, even current research in this area, is exploring tools to deliver some of these modalities remotely, making it more accessible, and incorporating wearable devices, again, to see how they impact the physiology, how the heart rate changes, how the blood pressure changes, and so forth. Biofeedback and heart rate variability are increasingly being studied for personalized stress management tools. And again, just like with diet and exercise, it's hard to study these interventions in isolation. In terms of integrative care, it really incorporates whole person approach, and we're still kind of learning how to measure the synergy of all these things where we're so used to studying, again, just one variable at a time. Telemedicine is playing a big role in allowing us to access practitioners for mindfulness, yoga, tai chi more readily. And again, this is another big shift towards overall healing-based care model. Final thoughts, while I would say the research in these areas continues to evolve, I do believe strongly that we have access to some of the most powerful tools for healing, and that is through how we eat, how we move, and how we take care of our spirit. And even small changes can build a lot of momentum. So thank you for listening, and thank you for all the presence you all bring to this journey. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Pandya. That was just a wonderful presentation and very apropos to our society today. And so thank you. Thank you so much. And I know there'll be lots of questions for you as well. I actually just want to say a few words before we have you ask questions. I just want to say a few words about Cancer Care's free programs and services. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization. We offer free programs and services to people throughout the United States. And we can be reached on our Hope line at 800-813-4673 or our website, www.cancercare.org. Our website is accessible to people throughout the world. Our Hope line is for people to call throughout the United States. We offer a host of services from both online support groups, financial assistance and copay assistance, and help with transportation. We also offer a host of online support groups, which you'll be able to see on our website. And the online support groups are quite variable, so that you'll be able to see all of the online support groups that we offer on our website. And now I'm going to move on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask our operator to explain to you how to queue up for questions. I'm going to ask Bella to explain that to all of you. Bella?
Thank you. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So I'll start with this question. This is for Ms. Taramello. Can you comment on the extent to which current cancer research is being affected by the current administration's anti-science stance, reduction in funding and or cancellation of existing federally funded clinical trials? And thank you, Ms. Taramello, for centering equity and cultural sensitivity in clinical research. So, Dr. Offen, do you want to start with that question?
Sure. That is a difficult question to answer in the current environment. What I would say is, in general, we all remain laser-focused on our patients and advancing cancer care. Obviously, with changes in funding abilities from what have been traditionally grant apparatuses to help our patients and our understanding of cancer, it has kind of led to all of us having to evolve our research strategies. For instance, one of the largest funding opportunities for people like us tends to be through the NIH and NCI government programs, and those have been openly altered under the current administration. That doesn't mean there's not other avenues and opportunities that we explore, both from foundational grants, Department of Defense grants, and others. But it does require all of us to reevaluate the ways in which we get the necessary funding to perform our research. But I think it's important to, again, say out loud to the patients and caregivers on the call, our research continues. It's just a bit more complex trying to figure out ways in which to move it forward.
And to some extent, if all of our seekers are able to treat such a complicated disease as cancer, I think that they probably will come up with some innovative ways to access funding for clinical trial research, because it's so important. I think the research of today really becomes the current treatment for cancer. And for those of us who've been in the field for a very long time, we've seen tremendous breakthroughs in the treatment of cancer over the many decades. And Dr. Fine, this question for you. Can you define the acronym CAR in CAR T cell therapy?
Absolutely, and thanks for bringing that up. So CAR here stands for chimeric antigen receptor, and that's a lot of tricky definition that's built into those three words. But what we're really saying there is, instead of so if you want to think about it as there's like a puzzle piece, and you've got the perfect puzzle piece to match the puzzle piece that's sitting on the outside of the cell you're targeting. So that's your antigen receptor, that you've got the one that fits perfectly with it. And the chimeric part is that we're putting it in there. It's not something that comes naturally from the cell. We're adding it to the cell from the outside and making that combination or chimera. So that's where that term comes from.
And another question from our participants. Are there any immune checkpoint inhibitors that cross the blood-brain barrier? Who would like to take that question?
Very quickly jump in? It's basically not as simple as immune checkpoint inhibitors, but also will the immune system itself cross the blood-brain barrier, the immune system you create. I speak from the area of melanoma, where the use of checkpoint inhibitors definitely has shown activity within the brain, and so it's an evolving area, but we do have evidence that it can do so, and that evidence in the realm of melanoma, at least, is fairly robust.
Excellent. Anyone else want to comment on that?
Dr. Fine again. Just to expand that to the CAR T cell world, we also have evidence that CAR T cells can cross that blood-brain barrier, and so we certainly see for patients who have lymphomas or leukemias with brain involvement with, that they are useful tools in treating those diseases.
And then we have a question. Are there clinical trials that examine prevention and screening instead of those who are currently diagnosed with cancer? I would like to take that one. Prevention and screening.
I can speak to that. This is Mike Offen from Sloan Kettering. I can speak to that from a solid tumor lung cancer type of perspective. There's a lot of research that has been done and is ongoing for cancers, particularly those that have known relationships to exposures, be it smoking or other types of exposures, where we'll actually do screening modalities. That's all born out of prior clinical trials. There are some trials which will be ongoing and are ongoing looking at markers such as DNA in the bloodstream that could come from tumors that may predict the potential chance of a person having an early stage cancer that we can't see. those are not necessarily considered standard of care at this time, but there are a lot of companies and a lot of money vested in trying to figure out ways for earlier detection before we may be even able to see it necessarily on routine imaging. So the answer is there definitely are. It's not necessarily widely integrated across all tumors, but it's something we are all very interested in pursuing.
Dr. Wong, I just want to quickly add as well is that there is also a long history of that happening. So the screening for GI tumors, the screening for using mammography, so the screening in high risk for lung cancer using imaging. So I want to point out that there is very robust data looking backwards. And of course, as my colleague said, there's a multitude of trials using many of the new technologies moving forward. It's just a little less, overt and sexy, I guess that's another word, than treatment-related clinical trials, but they're definitely there.
Excellent. And a question for Dr. Pandya. How have integrative medicine and lifestyle changes been implemented in current research studies?
A great question. I think, if you just look at the research that's been published in integrative modalities over the last 20 years, I think, I don't remember the exact numbers off the top of my head, but since like the late 90s to now, it has gone up by hundreds fold, if not more than that. So there's a lot more research looking at, again, how diet impacts cancer risk, how exercise improves not only quality of life, but again, looking specifically at outcomes in cancer themselves. So there are, multiple centers that have popped up, including at Memorial Sloan Kettering and elsewhere, where large-scale integrative research is being done actively. And I'm excited to see the future as more and more of these studies come out.
Thank you.
If I may, Carol, this is Susan Swoven.
Yes.
Just to make everybody aware that when we do clinical trials, whether it's looking at novel agents or novel ways of giving standard of care drugs, we always like to assess quality of life, and that could be in the form of questionnaires or other evaluations such that patients are being very, very closely monitored to make sure that their quality of life is maintained and if there's any untoward toxicities that had not been previously detected. So when we talk about quality of life, it's on multiple levels from the time a patient walks in to see how they're doing just as a baseline to undergoing standard of care therapies and also if they're in a clinical trial. This is what we do all the time through a variety of different methodologies.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Ms. Haramelo, have there been any recent studies published discussing diverse representation in clinical trials?
Sure. So absolutely, I believe the CDC publishes a lot of cancer research, especially cancer research and disparities. But I will also say that even if patients are not aware of any of the research or any of the statistics or data, speaking to your providers and trying to get a little bit more information about clinical trials in general, I believe that most patients may be fearful or they may have a misconception. So really talking to providers and doing outside research in nonprofit organizations can really help in staying up to date about current research and even just engaging in education workshops like these that bring more knowledge about how to engage in some of these opportunities.
Thank you so much. Well, I would just like to thank all of our speakers. This has been a phenomenal program when you think about it. It's been, we have 10 speakers talking for an hour and 15 minutes, presenting on every type of cancer and all the different cancer treatments, and it's been really a phenomenal program. Both the speakers have been phenomenal, as have been the questions that have been asked. And as we wrap up this program today, I just want to thank all of our participants. I also want to thank all of our speakers, really, for addressing all these questions. There are many more questions that we didn't get to, but just to show that how interested you all are in these topics. And again, I just really cannot thank our speakers enough or our participants enough for participating in this really this is one of the longest programs that we do, and I just want to thank you all for participating, and I want to wish you all just a very fine day. I also just want to say that I want you all to know that we've discovered that many people have difficulty with accessing their healthcare team evenings, weekends, and holidays. So please be sure when you call your physicians during the day. Usually you can reach them during the day, but evenings, weekends, and holidays seem to be challenging to reach your healthcare provider. So please do call, get the phone number of your physicians for weekends, evenings, and holidays. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you again all for participating in this, this really amazing program. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.